page 16, I've got some additional commentary on this same thing. This combines these two existing statutes with two significant modifications. The prohibition is extended to include devices for forging any written instrument and not limited to evidence of death. Reason to limit. And then two, the manufacture or possession of a device specifically designed for use in counterfeiting is made a criminal act, and an intent to use the device unlawfully is required only with respect to devices capable of or adaptable to use in such counterfeiting and forgery. Under subsection one, the state must prove the requisite knowledge by the defendant. It need not prove the intent to use the item for forgery, but they would have to do it under two.
Mm-hmm.
Have we approved that?
No.
I saw you.
Second. We moved to technically to 6 as is, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. 6 is good. Excellent.
No simulation.
I am.
I can't take pressure anymore.
I'm not trying to anticipate what you're going to say, Mr. Chairman.
Can I guess? May I ever get a cup of coffee before we get into it?
Did you think I made a typo on that?
Yeah.
Give it first to the kids.
He checked your typing on that.
We're going to suggest we should move this over to the sex part.
Me, tomorrow, honors. Jenny Hosley. In such a manner that it appears to have an antiquity, rarity, source, or authorship. It does not in fact possess, but that all has been intended to be proven. For with knowledge of its good character and the intent to be proven, the utters, how can the utter of antique chair?
Put your copyright law present. Put your copyright law and so on. Take care of this.
Well, no, I don't think so. This is aimed at, false paint.
Yeah.
Antiques.
Art objects, all kinds of.
Hammering a broken desk with a hammer. I'd say let the buyer beware.
I've got my 70 for him.
I've got the ones that really get to be a problem are not the guy who phonies the furniture and sells it at the secondhand store and so forth. But there is a considerable amount of things like art forgery, and the amounts involved are huge.
Sure.
You know, was this guy in Texas here a few months ago that wound up and made about $6 million for a bunch of French paintings that were not, they were the only thing you could say about them was they were French paintings that weren't by the guy they were supposed to be by.
Well, I think there's another consideration. As our society becomes much more mobile and this particular type of criminal becomes much more sophisticated, these kinds of transactions take place all over the world, and if we didn't have a statute to possibly cover this kind of thing, and the crime occurred in this jurisdiction,
then we should have a crime here.
Well, isn't this covered by some kind of larceny?
Well, it would if he gets this would get to him before the theft was consummated.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is, and I in Michigan set it out, and I quote from the Michigan commentary on this. They say the preparation of this sort of object shows careful advanced planning, and since the monetary stakes are often very high, it appears appropriate to penalize the preparation as such, particularly when apprehension of the criminal after the final fraud has been perpetrated is often very difficult. So this is designed to get to him before the theft has been completed. He was actually peddled.
Yeah, and make a basis for a search warrant or something. If somebody has knowledge that he's making it, I'm telling you, as it is now, there's no crime to make something.
Right, and no basis for the issuance of a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you caught, it's 170.45 in its entirety, right, Tom? Was that previously a crime in New York before the 65 criminal code?
No, I think it was.
Yeah, I guess it was. 1923.
The model penal code, of course, has a section on this, too. It's set out on page 1922, section 224 and 22.
Well, I assume that the definitions that we started with in the beginning of this section or chapter are applicable here, right?
Yes.
Well, we talked about utter on page 2. To utter a written instrument means to issue, deliver, or publish, circulate, disseminate, transfer, or tender a written instrument to another. We're talking here about uttering possibly not only written instruments, but something that's beyond that is utter. Does utter need to be verified? Somebody could say, well, according to your definition, uttering is restricted simply to written instruments. And here we've got a Van Gogh painting. And so my man tried to transfer it to another, but it's not technically uttered.
I have a signature on it. Don't they all have a signature or something?
What could be a simulated signature?
Well, what he said, what Ed's saying is it's got a signature published.
Be written.
Written. Well, do we need to utter as, certainly if he uttered it, he possessed it. Didn't he?
Yeah, right. With knowledge of his true character and with intent to defraud. Well, that's kind of an inchoate intent, if you just make it in possession. I know that it's phony, and I intend to defraud somebody with it someday, but I'm not about to do it, and I just possess it. How are you going to prove that I intended to defraud? Yeah, unless I give you a statement or...
Or, of course, a conduct or something.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard pressed in the absence of some evidence of a continuing course of conduct.
And uttering doesn't help you prove it, does it?
Well, I think that is the right expression.
It doesn't seem to fit.
I don't even like the word utter at all. To me, it's a
utter
fool. No, you know, I mean, the thing that most people recognize him in is he's an utter fool type of thing. And I,
well, that's why I tried to find
mental pictures of him.
I think your question's a good one, John. Couldn't you correct it by saying for the purposes of this subsection, utter means the same as I defined in subsections 7 and section 1? Well, but I think that's implicit. The thing that concerns me is if we want to make it applicable to this section, it's got to have, it can't be restricted just to written instruments as it is in subsection. First, the model penal code and New York use this.
They use utter, but they don't define it.
But they don't define it before. And I think you're tied into the previous sections.
Well, what would you think of amending sub 7 under section 1 to after a written instrument, say, a written instrument or object. To utter a written instrument or object means to issue, deliver, publish,
or object. Object is modified by written. You can say...
Written instrument or other object.
To utter.
Yeah, other object.
Well, why couldn't you say, to utter means to issue, deliver, publish, circulate, disseminate, transfer, or tender a written instrument or other object? Yeah. And cut out the written instrument in person.
Yeah, I'd do that.
You saw me, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to make all those administrative rulings again.
I was accused the other day of running the meeting like Senator Mahoney. And
No. I can catch
you. You need a lot of practice.
You've got a long way to go before you're in that class.
All right. It's moved and seconded that we amend section 1, sub 7 by deleting written instrument, by deleting a written instrument on the first line and insert or other object following the instrument on the last line of that subsection. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The signature of the maker, and fraudulently persuade the individual to sign this.
By telling them a mistaken fact.
Right.
Well,
that would be an example.
I don't know if the Burns Law Office was $200 instead of $20.
It's my famous termite case. The guys go out and tell her that, tell this old girl to, that she should sign this, she should give them this check for $5,000 for getting rid of the termite. But that's OMFP. Can you see the situation here which wouldn't be OMFP? We've done away with the false token requirement for false pretenses.
Right, and that's why I felt we needed a separate section on this, because we've done away with OMFP, but in doing away with it, we didn't pick up this phrase that says, or obtains or attempts to obtain the signature of any person with any writing, the false making of which would be punishable as forgery. We didn't retain, and that hasn't been picked up in our adapter.
That doesn't say that.
Says he obtains the signature of a person to a written instrument.
I mean,
I would think with an intent to mention that this would have a case where the person is successful in establishing that the beneficiary of a will used that minute to sign it. The next step would be charging with his crime.
If the inducement was false written.
Well,
I suppose anybody comes to you and gets you to draw a will for.
No, not necessarily.
And you change the beneficiary.
Goody, goody, man, many, he'll say, I don't know what she's doing. I want to tell her some mean things that somebody said about her.
Now, because you're making representations.
Let's suppose she just comes to you to draw a will and things are kind of tough right now, and you know they haven't been issued and not going to be long in this world, and instead of making them. Oregon Historical Society, the beneficiary of the balance for estate, you make Bruce Spaulding the beneficiary of the balance for estate. And she comes in and you say, well, Aunt Minnie, here's your will just like you told me to do it, but she doesn't bother reading, she signs it and walks out and drops dead on the sidewalk. That's what this is, isn't it?
Well,
yeah, how do you prove an intent to defraud? This is
not obtain money by false pretenses.
I obtain signatures on documents every day. Boy, you're getting close to home here now. I don't know.
I hope that you don't do this by a misrepresentation of fact, which you know to be false.
Do you want to abstain from voting on this?
No, I don't want to abstain. I want very much to vote.
And you don't do this with an intent to injure or defraud.
No, I don't, and I...
You have a right to remain silent.
Despite what some plaintiff's lawyers might say.
I don't intend to defraud, and I don't intend to leave out any significant facts, and I don't intend to do anything wrong. It says right on the document, read before signing and all that. But without my statement, that I intended to defraud, can it be proven that I intended to defraud by an accumulation of other evidence that just happens to be a fact that I don't know about? This is a problem. Well, I think it's very real.
You don't have to have an intent to defraud if you have an intent to acquire a substantial benefit.
So there'd be no benefit to you.
But it might be for another. Which would be the company?
Well, it might be your company.
Yeah.
But take the Aunt Minnie example. Isn't this really putting the district attorney into a civil lawsuit? I mean, the Oregon Historical Society should contest that will or file a suit against Bruce Spaulding for fraud. And to bring the DA into it and prosecute.
Yeah, one further effect on the
automatically disbarred from this poll, Mr. Simpson wouldn't be.
Well, no,
if you have a civil, you're not watching the criminal.
No, it wouldn't automatically, because it's anticipated this would be a misdemeanor category.
Oh.
But, well, now, I'd like to point out
to sell
that,
better.
That this kind of conduct.
We're getting silly
toward the end of this. We're all getting.
What are you selling?
What is it, Dan?
What was my point?
This kind of conduct, you're going to point out.
Yeah. Now, I don't think this would take the DA into it any more than the DA would be in this kind of a hypothetical situation under the false pretense statute now. Because you're talking about a weed, the weed. Boy, that's not long that.
I think anybody who's involved in anything like this is going to go to a district attorney.
A little
one has one. Criminal prosecution in addition to whatever civil remedies are available.
Falsely obtaining a signature to a will now would be criminal under 165205, because it provides that if he obtains with intent to defraud, if he obtains the signature of any person to any writing, the false making of which would be punishable as forgery.
That'll be punished under this section under false pretense. Well, now, did that be covered by our comprehensive theft eliminating the obtained securing signature bill, right? 205 is consolidated into our comprehensive theft statute, except for the provision that you can cover
next
by this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's just my point, that I don't think that this is a great departure, referring into Bob's hypothetical about the will. I don't think it's any great departure from our present law.
Well, you say who attempts to obtain the life intent the signature of any person to any writing. I see what we did.
This is equally grave, I think, as this making somebody complete an uncompleted document for the purpose of gaining some benefit. Talking about earlier, if somebody comes in and gets me to sign a deed with a legal description I don't recognize, and it turns out that I'm giving me my house instead of selling a piece of sagebrush out east of town, I think that's a criminal act, whether I can recover the property or not.
Well, it does appear that this just separates that way. In as much as the remainder of 165205 is covered.
It's covered under theft.
Right. But we are just more or less simplifying the present.
Mm-hmm.
I think. Well, except for this, of course, what about a misrepresentation? Why do you say a misrepresentation of fact? Could be a misrepresentation of law. Obtain signature of person to written instrument by means of any misrepresentation, period, which he knows to be false.
Well, I wasn't trying to make it as broad as our definition of deception.
Otherwise, you'd never get an expert.
Except that now,
also require us under the copyright to accept part of this. And we're doing away with it now. Certainly, I would think that in most cases, you put, the kind of evidence you have in the absence of a confession would be circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, I was wondering how she takes it, because actually this is a, my God, this is a matter of concern to me, because I could ask people to sign a document, and I don't have all of the facts. And yet those facts could, if they were, known to me, yeah, it could be pretty damaging.
All right, why don't you get a signature to the document, though, and you later find out that these facts, the facts on which you've asked these signatures to be put on the document, the facts that you represented them were false, what are they going to do with it? They're going to go through it, send it to the company, they're going to go back and tell them you were wrong, and you'd like to have, you'd have to go over again.
You'd have to, if you found out about that soon, you'd be all right.
I'm passing around the.
You're going to find out before your prosecutor works, aren't you?
I'm passing around the petition.
Then you can rectify it, I suppose. I don't know. I'm not sure if you can. I don't think you can.
Intent to defraud or injure another, or to acquire a substantial benefit for himself or another.
Mm-hmm.
So I pass out a petition.
You represent something.
If you sign this petition, you'll lower your property tax.
Of course, the our definition of written instrument would apply to this section.
Representation doesn't necessarily have to be in words.
The written instrument definition would apply to the petition.
This is signed by, obtained by insurance adjuster.
That any harder than any conventional
The Supreme Court.
When the Supreme Court says
that.
Well, yeah.
You can't even win on appeal on this.
Yeah, the insurance adjuster knows that the injured person is talking about only property damage or something. It gets them by a fast talk, makes a representation, and that's all it applies to. It gets a signature on there, you don't even find.
He can represent that we're satisfied that your doctor bill is going to be $200. And they get time that could be reasonably accurate.
Well, reasonably accurate at that time, then he shouldn't be prosecuted.
Well, but the man comes along later, and then if we get a court presenting this evidence, it looks entirely different.
Well, it goes to intent at the time, though.
Well, I can remember in the actual case where the insurance goes around to get a release, and he sees the gal is holding him up for $210 property damage, but he sees her in back breaks, and he's goddamn glad to get that signature on there for $210. I sustained that way in your court, though.
Well, of course,
right now.
Let's get back to this bar and Bruce. Maybe you'll feel better about this whole thing.
No, I think we're in the same boat.
Well, if it's not insurance, that's the lawyer in the same boat. That's never going to go.
I would want to eliminate the words of fact, like you did, John. Representation of law. People are supposed to know the law.
They presume the law.
Well, misrepresentation of law, misrepresentation of fact of this type of thing. Anyway.
No, it might be.
If I go in and tell
one lawyer will have one opinion of what the law is, and another will have exactly the opposite opinion. So, you've got a tough thing to...
But I would say there are honest differences, and you can have honest differences in the law. Suppose somebody goes in and says that...
It's nice to sit here and talk about the honest differences, but when you get the IRA person that he is induced to sign something, this IRA person goes to the district attorney and demands I have this fellow prosecuted. At the least, it seemed to me like something like this can cause unneeded and unnecessary embarrassment.
Isn't that entirely possible right now under 165-205?
But it says, if done, would be a forgery. I don't know exactly what that means, but at least it seemed to add something more to it than...
What's that number?
205.
Yeah, the false making of which would be a forgery.
Which would obtain with like intent the signature of any person to any writing, the false making of which would be punishable as
a forgery.
As forgery. Now,
punishable as a forgery.
That's defining the kind of writing we're talking about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The signature of any person to any writing, so then you have to look back to forgery to see what kind of writing he's talking about.
So then that wouldn't apply to me.
Public records, certificate, return, attestation of a clerk.
And I would, my reading of it would include the writing set out in 165-105 and 165-110.
A used car salesman, my primary purpose is to require substantial benefit for myself. And almost by definition of my job, I did. But if I commit the crime of fraudulently obtaining a signature, if I obtain the person's signature to a contract by representing that this car is good and it doesn't have sawdust in the crankcase, when in fact it does, and the poor sucker flies and drives it down the street, and
you know that it does.
You know, this thing came up, that question came up in small claims court in Deschutes County the other day, and the judge over there, the people came in and said that the car that they had been sold, you know, just between two individuals, they said that the car they had been sold didn't run properly after they obtained this car, therefore they wanted to recover from the people who sold it to them. And the judge said some pretty alarming things there.
Well, you ought to go sit in that court of law, he would say alarming things all the time.
Yeah, he does worry about that particular judge, but...
if he's not a court of law anyway, it's a court of equity. All district courts are courts of equity.
Okay, but... okay, semantics, but...
by practice, not by statute.
Yeah. But it sure... that's the sort of thing that can give you some pretty disquieting moments if you're selling things to the public, used items and so on. How in the world do you know of all the defects of a used item if you're dealing in used merchandise? So you have to get a sales contract in which to sell this thing, and then you always, invariably, would have a problem here, it seems to me. I don't know how many people you're going to jail with this law.
We're
kind of
talking about...
maybe I'm unduly alarmed about nothing. But it is...
I've never heard of a prosecution on this part of the chain. Statute, have you... about the thing, the signature?
No, I kind of facetiously raised the issue about the used car, but I'm glad you followed up on that, although I wonder if maybe some of these so-called consumer protection statutes that we're commencing to pass now aren't more appropriately designed to cover this.
I think probably they are. And those people that deal in those goods must be... they must stay awake at night.
It's about time they stay awake at night. They've been keeping their customers awake at night for years.
Yeah, well, there's a great deal of fraud in that field, of course.
Staying awake at night trying to figure out how to get their customers.
There's a great deal of fraud in there, but there's some inadvertent
there's
fraud,
a
too.
I suspect more of it's inadvertent than...
yeah. I don't have any grief for the used car dealer that turns back speedometer, knowing I know they'll do it. But still, at the same time, a used car can have a lot of defects, and you can point to many pieces of circumstantial evidence, and you can pretty well prove that there was intent to defraud, I think. Maybe there really wasn't. I don't know, it's a tough field.
If we pass this, it goes out as a recommendation, and it ever gets the full force of effect law, it's going to make a lot of people block.
A little more carefully.
You got it right.
Of course, the other thing, we're talking about the insurance bill. Really, you're almost an ad prosecute the company, too.
Oh, yes. But it's a daily thing. And it's also a fact that you do not know all of the facts surrounding this thing. And you should have known. And any lawyer can have this come home to you. He can have I've heard a lot of lawyers come out in the hall and talk to their clients and say, "This is the first time I ever heard that." when the step down on the witness stand. So there are many things that you don't know when you're dealing with people. Yet it could be, you can find a set of circumstances pretty easily to prove the intent to be fraud.
I had a freezer salesman one time, you know, one of these home freezer plans things, so he got himself into a bind. And the problem there, that morally there was probably no intention to defraud, but he had made representations to the customer that went so far beyond anything the company had given him in the book, or that he had any reason on the basis of his experience to believe could be true or would come true, that while there may not have been moral responsibility, I think subconsciously or something, he wanted to make that sale so badly that he just kind of beguiled his disregard for the fact situation. Whether he would come under intention to defraud or not, I don't know. I don't think he had the malice kind of thing that would take the criminal intention, but from the customer's point of view, he'd been sold a bill of goods on the basis of representation for which there was no factual basis.
Well, I suppose that you conclude that you didn't have a chance to defraud.
Yeah, he's permitted some puppet.
Yeah, we wrote that in earlier.
Sales puppery. Yeah, I remember that.
The rhyme's good. Means nothing.
Yeah, that's not good. What's the wish? What's the.
Well, I think.
That's what I'm thinking about.
If you cut out the words of the team, if you have
a chance
to
do it,
probably not.
Yeah, I'm a fraud to you. At least.
It's the same general language of both New York and Michigan. Almost exactly.
Yes.
Is it
require a substantial benefit for himself or another or a third person. The same elements.
The record will show that Section 8 passed with 3 voting for and 1 abstention. Now, that's a little bit different concept on shows we hear with respect to the Illinois criminal code, where they have forgery as part of a deceptive practice section. And this same thing is set out under the Commission of Deceptive Practice.
I think the thrust of Illinois is pretty much the same, at least that one subsection are covered by fraudulent obtaining signatures.
Okay. That covers forgery. We proved forgery draft number one practically in total. And my suggestion would be that rather than a retype this, it could be amended by interlineation.
Yeah,
there's just three or four
small changes.
And why don't those of us who have who brought our own books leave them with Mildred and let her amend them and note that and send them to us rather than do that?
Well,
I
probably have to send them out anyway for the commission.
I didn't bring them.
When they go to the commission, I'll have to be typing. You know, I won't be typing it. Maybe a couple pages. So I'll be typing a couple pages.
Well, it's as you wish. Whatever would be easiest. I see no need really to type up. If you'll me another. Now, that concludes the meeting, I guess. Is there anything else, Tom?
No, just by general information, we sent a notice out to you yesterday. You may have not had a chance to see it yet. With respect to the commission meeting that's been called for the 21st to the 22nd of November, the first day, that's a Thursday and a Friday. Thursday would be devoted to a work session to go over preliminary drafts that have been approved by the subcommittee. We would have drafts of subcommittee number 1 and 3 for certain, and hopefully we may have the first kidnapping draft from subcommittee number 2, which is going to be meeting next week. The second day, Thursday the 22nd of November, Sanford Kadish, who's one of the 4 reporters from Northern California Penal Code Revision and professor of law at California Law School in Berkeley, has agreed to come up and spend the day with the commission to discuss just about anything we want to talk about, but specifically some of the items we talked about on telephone, our letter, the unresponsibility and the court crimes and culpability elements, and some of these extremely important sections that California has been through and that Katie should work on. He's certainly a recognized authority in this area, and I think it's going to be extremely beneficial to the commission. If I mention this, when you have a little advance notice, probably find
the 21st and 22nd?
Yeah, you'll find the notice on your desk when you get back to the hall.
Well, where are we going from here now? We'll be happy to know that we've completed our first assignment. We finished crimes and its property, right? Well, what about credit?
Well, no, we still have some other sections to, we've got to decide with respect to bad checks, for example. We have now is NSF checks. We want to do with respect to those credit cards. And there may be some other minor sections that I think we at least ought to consider whether the subcommittee will want to adopt any of these other sections. One, I know that we'll want to look at, which is covered now, and that's the question of manufacture or possession of slugs or vending machines.
There's a, New York has a forgery that treats the manufacturer of slugs and so forth, a forgery that
they have a separate section on slugs.
I thought they had a somewhere in there.
They have 170.50
and 170.60 unoccupied slugs. Well,
if you're
right. They have 2 degrees. And if they not belong to an organization. Now, I don't know what ones they were or whether anything. I just heard that.
Project has been assigned to subcommittee number 2. Now, as you know, up until now, the subcommittee number 1 has been the one that's had the lion's share of work to do because we just didn't have enough reporters and draftsmen to keep all the subcommittees busy.
Yep.
And you might be interested that subcommittee number 1 right now is approaching the end of its work in the first drafts of Crimes Against Property. And we hope to have that completed by the end of November. And kidnapping was selected really arbitrarily as a starting point in Crimes Against Persons because we felt that it would be something that would be not too controversial and something that this subcommittee could cut its teeth on, so to speak, and get underway in this drafting process. Now, under Crimes Against Persons, the homicide offenses, some time back, Professor Platt of the University of Oregon Law School, who's one of our reporters and who is working with subcommittee number 3, expressed an interest in this area, and so out of the Crimes Against Persons, homicide has been assigned already and had been assigned prior to our hiring Ms. Lambert.
Let me interrupt you right now. What do you mean by, what's the term reporters? What does that designate?
Well, they're the draftsmen, people who are drafting these drafts for the subcommittees.
Now, is this, for instance, kidnapping related preliminary draft? This is proposed legislation.
Yeah, this is the first draft that's been put together by Ms. Laverato here, and for the initial consideration by this subcommittee. And the way we've functioned with the other subcommittees, we've had the initial draft prepared along with commentary to show you how it relates to our present law. And to show you how it compares with the model penal code and how it compares also maybe with New York revised penal law, the Illinois revised penal code, and Michigan, and some of the other states. And this is then presented for your consideration and can be reworked and amended as this subcommittee sees fit. And then when this subcommittee has determined that it's satisfied with the draft, then it will be presented to the full commission.
Now, may I inquire, at what point of all these, this program, did the public be invited to come in and comment, et cetera?
Well, and point of time, that's a hard question to answer. It will be probably not before next year sometime.
Well, I mean at what juncture of the program, when it is, if then, when it's before the full committee?
Yeah, now here's what we're doing. The drafts that have been tentatively approved by the full commission, those are the ones that, for example, our consolidated theft draft, theft of services draft, burglary and criminal trespass, criminal mischief, and there are one or two others. Those are being circulated after they've been tentatively approved.
They are circulated.
Yeah, and we
generally circulated, or to the bar.
Well, not to all the bar. We're sending them to the bar committee on criminal law. We're sending them to the board of governors of the bar. We're sending them to the district attorneys association. The Association of Police Chiefs, the Sheriff's Association, Public Defender, and the ACLU and all these different groups are receiving copies of these. Now, we're going to have to wait to see what kind of a feedback we get from these various groups. When we send these drafts out, we invite their criticism and their comments, and depending on what we get in the way of return comments from these various groups, including the judges and district attorneys and these various people who are interested in the administration of the criminal law, then we'll have to decide which areas are going to require some public hearings. In other words, we're going to try to be selective and schedule hearings on those areas where we feel that hearings are necessary.
Are in any instances, are you tend to make suggestions to the next session prior to the submission of the, I mean of any specific amendments, prior to submission of the entire document?
No, we don't.
Okay. Now, we've got this preliminary draft.
Now, I think a good way to do this, the first time through this, is to now just turn the meeting over, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, and ask Ms. Laverotta to go ahead and proceed through her draft and explain it to you.
Okay. What I'll do is go through section by section, and maybe if you have any comments, it will save them until the very end. And then I think maybe you'll see how each of the sections relates to the other. If you just want to jot it down, or if I don't make something clear and you think it should be, then you can close it enough. The way I did this, I started out with a definition section. Now, the definition will be used all through the draft in each of the sections. So it's important that at the beginning you go over the definition, and then later in the draft you'll see exactly how they relate. Now, the first one was restrain. I must call your attention to restrain meaning an intentional restriction of a person's movement so as to interfere substantially with his liberty.
And that's the question there.
Yes.
How does that distinguish between that and arrest?
Well, if you go further and down, by confining within a place of restriction commences on a place where it's moved without his consent and with knowledge of the restriction is unlawful.
How do you distinguish between that and unlawful arrest?
Well, an unlawful arrest, if the officer knows it's unlawful.
Well, I don't mean by unlawful, but if I stop you here and hold you here, I've arrested you, haven't I?
Well, yeah, but now, are you...
No, I mean that. There is such a...
What's your basis for calling it an arrest?
It's the basis of a civil action. Could be the basis of civil action. I restrict your movement. Unlawful.
And if you know it's unlawful, then you're going to be subject to that unlawful...
Isn't that correct?
Well, I don't know what you define as an arrest in Oregon, but it will be an unlawful imprisonment.
Yeah, of course, we want to remember that we're talking about penal, criminal provisions here in this draft. I mean, this isn't going to concern itself with civil law.
I'm just trying to learn.
Yeah.
Well, I think it'll be a little bit clearer later on because we define an unlawful imprisonment as a criminal offense, and this will be new to Oregon. So you'll just wait until we get to that section. The thing I want you to know here is without his consent and with knowledge that the restriction is unlawful. And this will come up in the case of police officers making an arrest, which is an unlawful arrest. Restraint is without consent, and there are two main provisions of when it's without consent, by physical force, intimidation, and deception. And number two, which is new, any means, including acquiescence of the victim, if the child is less than 16 years old, or an incompetent person, and the guardian has not consented. Abduct means to restrain. This incorporates all the provisions of the above restraint and adds two elements with intent to prevent liberation by secreting or holding in a place where the person is not likely to be found or using or threatening to use deadly physical force.
All right, now that word deadly.
Deadly.
Is that, never ran across that?
Deadly physical force will be defined in the code in the preliminary article. And I noticed in here that we're proceeding on the assumption that deadly physical force.
The bottom of page two there.
Bottom page two will mean physical force that under the circumstances in which it is used is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. Now, this is the differentiate between just the amount of force it would take to, like, you know, just put a blindfold on a person or tie them versus deadly force where you'd have a knife or a loaded revolver.
Well, now, why is, you can answer this, I know, but I haven't yet found it. Where is deadly physical force? Why is the, there must be a reason why that's emphasized or specified deadly rather than just physical force.
The reason is because a duck will define the offense of kidnapping, and for kidnapping it should be a serious, substantial force, one that would cause permanent injury or maybe death. And so for that reason, we're defining physical force as deadly physical force and not just any physical force. This will be to make the more serious form of force that would be used for kidnapping versus the lesser amount of force it would take to simply restrain a person.
You say that word deadly, is that found in some prior legislation?
Deadly physical force is the term that's used in the Michigan Code and is used in the Montana Penal Code. This is drafted, like I say, on the assumption that we will use that definition of deadly physical force. And if it's not, then we will have to go back to this draft and change it. Because the preliminary definitions haven't been drafted yet. Relative, the only thing to know under there is, I include adoptive relative, or of the same degree, through marriage or adoption. And this is to cover the step-parent situation or the adoptive sibling. So there would be no question about who would be in the role of parent or brother, sister. But that's pretty clear. This takes us then to page 5 in section 2, which defines the basic offense of kidnapping. Now, kidnapping is divided into two degrees. Kidnapping in the second degree and kidnapping in the first degree. Kidnapping in the second degree is the basic offense, and it consists of abducting another person. We have included under section 2, if you look, it's in brackets. This is an optional provision. This is to cover the situation of parental kidnapping cases and to provide that a parent who kidnaps his own child or a relative in close degree, as defined, who kidnaps a child for the sole purpose of taking custody, would not come under the kidnapping section and would not be prosecuted for kidnapping. Section 3, kidnapping in the first degree, is an aggravated form of the basic offense of kidnapping. And this incorporates an unlawful purpose, a further unlawful purpose besides the abduction. Now, the main purpose in kidnapping in the first degree has always been to kidnap.
I'll take away a minute. Just let me go a little slower.
Okay, I'm sorry. To compel a person to pay ransom or reward. If you'll notice in A, to compel a person to pay or deliver money or property as ransom. And then instead of the word reward, I've added, or to engage in other particular conduct, or to refrain from engaging in particular conduct. This is to cover the situations of using a person as a shield or a hostage, or holding them to compel someone to do some other act or to refrain from doing that. This expands the definition, I think, and avoids the word reward, which has been interpreted in a number of different ways. The other B and sub C are optional to facilitate the commission of any felony or flight thereafter, or to inflict serious bodily injury, or to terrorize the victim or another. These do not exist in the Oregon law as such now. But they have been adopted in the Model Penal Code and in the New York and the Michigan revised codes.
Now, can I interrupt just for a minute? Now, B particularly is especially designed, isn't it, to cover the hostage situation where a crime is being committed and the actor is trying to get away from the police, or
right. and that's why, one of the reasons I made it optional, because to facilitate the commission of any felony or flight thereafter, if it's taking the person as a hostage, it will come under sub A, and it may not be necessary to include the sub B. But we may feel that there might be cases where the general wording of A wouldn't be sufficient, and we might want to include B.
Come back to that word deadly now. Is there any additional determination on that for use of that? That you know any case law on that use that word deadly?
On deadly? there is case law on this, and as a matter of fact, didn't you cite a case in here on that, or did you? But if you'll look at now this definition, at least what we assume will be a definition or a comparable definition that will be adopted for the purposes of our revision. It's in terms of force that's likely or readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury, sometimes referred to as serious bodily injury. Now, the general definitions will also include, for example, a definition of a deadly weapon as opposed to a dangerous weapon. Now, what we're attempting to do here is to have a comprehensive code that will employ certain terms in a uniform manner throughout the code. And deadly force, as interpreted by the drafters of the Model Penal Code, means substantially what Gene has indicated at the bottom of page 2 here. This is my recollection from commentary of the Model Penal Code. This does have a basis in case law, though I can't cite you a certain case offhand.
Okay, go right ahead.
If you'll note under section 3, I think you should just point out one other word, and this is substantial. You'll find it's a substantial distance from the vicinity where he's found, or for a substantial period in a place of isolation. This is important in light of the number of kidnapping cases that are kidnapping robbery cases or kidnapping rape cases, where the defendant has been prosecuted both for the offense of robbery or rape and also the offense of kidnapping. This has been done in a number of cases.
You mean the Chessman case?
The Chessman case is an example, and the Nolan case, where the defendant was convicted for kidnapping, was indicted and convicted for kidnapping to obtain the higher offense. And in this way, you can get a conviction of life imprisonment or the death penalty for conduct which actually amounted to just the offense of rape or robbery. And this is designed to prevent this. Now, the Model Penal Code has done this by using the word substantial to differentiate a detention which is would be of such a substantial duration and time that it would become a kidnapping versus a detention which would be just incidental to the commission of another crime, such as in a robbery situation where you would detain, like, the bank cashier in a separate room. You take him from the bank into another room and detain him for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, during which time you rob the bank. This would not be then a kidnapping and a rape and a robbery. It would be simply the offense of robbery. Now, New York, instead of choosing wording such as substantial, has put in an arbitrary time limit of 12 hours, saying that an abduction that would last more than 12 hours would then become a kidnapping situation. Now, I rejected that because I think there are problems whenever you pick an arbitrary time limit as far as when the commission of an offense becomes kidnapping versus just the offense that started out to be as robbery and rape. Then you've got the problem of what happens when you've held the person for 11 hours and 55 minutes. Then is it kidnapping or isn't it kidnapping? And there's a lot of arguments that could be made that
you know, 6 hours is a substantial enough detention that it should be then become kidnapping. So I thought we could avoid the problems of selecting an arbitrary time limit by following the model penal code and using substantial, and then it would be a matter of judicial interpretation at the time of trial whether, in fact, the person was taken a substantial distance or was held a substantial time. Now, if you turn the page on page 6, it says kidnapping in first degree is A, and there are some lines left out. Now, the penalty provisions have not yet been drafted and won't be drafted until the substantive crimes have been finished. And when they are drafted, it will read like kidnapping in first degree is a Class A felony or Class B felony, whatever it is made to be, except that if the victim is voluntarily released alive and without serious bodily injury in a safe place prior to trial, it is a Class C, or it will be a lesser offense.
If what?
If the victim, the person kidnapped, is released by the kidnapper alive and without serious bodily injury prior to the trial, then the offense will be a lesser offense. The penalty imposed will be lesser. Now, this is in the nature of a general mitigation provision that has been adopted by a large number of states in recent years. The policy decisions behind this are such that the feeling is that if there is an incentive to the kidnapper to release the victim alive, that the only type of incentive that will work is a substantial reduction in the penalty that will be imposed. Now, this has its, you know, its greatest impact in the case where a state has the death penalty, where the death penalty would be imposed if the victim wasn't released alive. But if he is released alive, then it would be reduced to, say, 20 years or 10 years. Now, when you don't have the death penalty, such as in Oregon where it's life imprisonment now, then the reduction will have to be substantial. It could be any kind of incentive. And then there are the arguments made that even if the reduction is substantial, that is this really an incentive? And is it the kind of incentive that you want to give to criminals? Do you want to deter kidnapping as a crime, or do you want the victim released alive? And this gets to be a value judgment.
We expect considerable discussion in this subcommittee on that.
I think we'll, I'll just go on and then we can come back to that and you can think about that.
Term, word, I've never encountered before, but you're not familiar. Word asportation. What's the definition of that?
Asportation?
Carrying away.
Carrying away.
Taking away.
Removing from the vicinity where you would initially meet the person. Then I think we'll flip to page 10 in section 4. This legislation, unlawful imprisonment in the second and first degree, will be new to Oregon. At the present time, there is no criminal statute covering unlawful imprisonment. Now, when you get to unlawful imprisonment, we will bring in the definition of restraint, which goes back to our definition section. A person commits a crime of unlawful imprisonment if he restrains another person. Number 2, sub 2, which is optional again, is put in.
What page?
Page 10.
Page 10.
Wait, way ahead of me. I want to read this.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll take more time then.
Mm-hmm. A person goes into Montgomery Ward's, and they sick or employees take him into a room there and lock the door for crimes if any have been committed.
If they do it intentionally with the idea of restraining him, they could come under unlawful imprisonment.
They would come under
second degree.
Under section?
4. 1-4.
Where's 4?
Page 10. Page 10.
See, and that incorporates the verb restrains, which is
defined
in section 1.
Involuntary servitude or under circumstances which expose the person restrained to a risk of serious bodily injury. Now, in this situation, up until now, we have excluded the situation where a parent or a relative would take a child under 16 without using force in confinement solely to take custody of the child. Now, in this section, if the child is exposed to a risk of serious bodily injury, the defense is no longer available to parent or relative. In other words, if a parent or relative would take a child under 16 to take custody of him without using force, but in so doing would cause the child to undergo a serious risk of bodily injury, then that parent or relative would be guilty of unlawful imprisonment in the first degree under this section. Okay.
Now, I don't want to jump around. But, well, where is the offense condemned, for instance, of a parent in custody? Like, there's no, it's like
that's
not
coming.
A, there is no order, restraining order to creep in under. Or B, there has been.
Okay, that's going to be covered in the very next section, custodial interference. Let's move to section 6 on page 12.
I see.
All right. Custodial interference in the second degree. It says a person commits the crime of custodial interference in the second degree if knowing, now this is the important part, that he has no legal right to do so. He takes or entices any child from the custody of its parent, guardian, or lawful, note lawful custodian. Now, if a parent, you said before there has been any temporary decree or anything, in such a situation, both parents would have a legal right to the child. And if one parent...
You mean now in the absence of a court order?
In the absence of any court order or any decree.
All right. Now let's assume there is a court order.
Now if there...
And let's take that word knowing he has no term, he has no legal right to do so.
Right.
Honest belief, although erroneous, would that be a complete defense?
Not in this situation, it wouldn't be.
Hmm?
No, it wouldn't be.
Would not be?
It would not be.
Well, the question of the defendant's knowledge, whether or not he knew he had a legal right, this would be a jury question.
That's what I said.
Yeah, this would be
what
a jury question. And the fact that an order...
So he could establish that, that he honestly believed that he had a right, and that would, and the jury found that he did so believe, that would be a complete defense.
Well, I would think so.
Yeah. I meant is if the custody decree had been handed down, that should be noticed to him, that
well,
he doesn't have a legal right.
I know, but let's assume that a man honestly believed that he had a right. Suppose those were the facts. Let's say that some attorney so advised, just like in the matter of malicious prosecution, suppose some attorney had advised him, oh, that isn't worth the paper it's written. He honestly believed that, and the jury found those were the facts, that he honestly believed that. Would that be a defense?
Yes, it would have to be.
I would say so. It'd be a jury question, the issue of knowledge,
yeah,
or whether he had a legal
right. If established as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think you can see the limitation to this custodial interference. Number one, it can only be enforced within the state. And so this isn't going to do any, you know, it, the situation in a real custody fight where the one parent will take the child out of the state, they'll take it beyond the state law anyway. And so, you know, we're not talking about that type of case. We're talking about the case where
this can only be enforced within the state of the residence.
Well, this particular law is only going to be enforced within Oregon. The problem is whether another state will give full faith and credit to.
Yeah.
We'd have to, and that would be
full faith and credit to the order or
to the custody decree. It's another problem, which is, you know, what we're talking about.
Yeah, you're talking about enforceability of the decree in another state.
Right, and that we can't get into right now.
You could be extradited in charge of this.
Well, the question of extradition on this, now, assuming that custodial interference in the second degree were a misdemeanor, you see, under our penalty structure, when these crimes are graded, and I would anticipate that this would be a misdemeanor. So you wouldn't have extradition available.
That's what I'm thinking, because it's got, I think, a 25-year sentence now.
Taking away what's intended to be taken, apparently,
And this is one of the reasons that, if you've noticed, we've been grading down all the way in the situation of a parent or relative taking a minor child. And this is to make it a lesser offense. This will also cover not only the situation of a minor child, but any incompetent or committed person from the lawful custody of another person or institution. And we've carefully spelled out what a committed person would be. This would be anyone committed under judicial warrant in the case of a juvenile, any orphan, neglected, or delinquent child, mentally defective or insane person, or other dependent or incompetent, entrusted to another's custody by or through a recognized social agency or otherwise by authority of law. And this would be the situation of juveniles in foster homes and situations like that. Now, Section 7, custodial interference in the first degree would be the greater offense of custodial interference. And a person would commit this when the person taken or enticed for lawful custody, this would be the child or the incompetent or committed person, when he was taken with a risk that his safety would be endangered or his health materially impaired. Now this situation was designed to protect the child. This is not to protect the parent who's taken. The other section was to protect the parent. This is to protect the child, so that if a parent, regardless of his good intention, would take a child under a situation in which the child's safety would be endangered or his health would be impaired, the parent is going to be guilty of a greater offense. Now what penalty this offense will carry will depend on what we make it when we come through with the penalty provision. But it was felt that, especially in a situation of like custody fight, the child's health is still, and safety is still at stake, and his health and safety shouldn't be risked by moving the child back and forth in these types of situations. And if this is going to happen, then the parent should face a stiffer penalty.
And that would probably fall in the felony category.
Probably, a Class C or felony.
Because that's, I noticed under the model penal code, that is a felony.
And the custodial interference in second degree is a misdemeanor.
No.
Now, the pages 14, 15, and 16, I just put in as a comparison. I thought it might be helpful to see what the proposed draft would be in comparison to the existing Oregon law. And it's set out section by section with just general comments such as we've been going over now. I think that's self-explanatory unless you want me to comment on it either.
Oh, you might. Why don't you run through that?
Okay. Kidnapping under the Model Penal Code is defined as only one degree, one offense of kidnapping. And this is the kidnapping for ransom situation.
Why do you suppose they don't distinguish?
The reason they did not distinguish between two degrees is it's felt, current legislation itself in the kidnapping area that except for the situation where you would kidnap a person for ransom or reward or as a hostage or shield, all other situations could be covered by the substantive crimes involved, such as rape or robbery or sex conversion or whatever is incidental. And you could aggravate the penalty under those sections if the detention was of a substantial for a substantial time or in a place of isolation. That could be an aggravating factor, say under the robbery section. And it would not necessarily have to be a separate offense of kidnapping. And it shouldn't be included in the kidnapping section. So under the model penal code, it would be comparable to our kidnapping, actually our kidnapping in the first degree, the way it's drafted in the proposed draft. The proposed draft has two sections, kidnapping in the second degree and kidnapping in the first degree. This is comparable to what is existing in Oregon now. ORS 163.610 would define the basic offense of kidnapping and would be kidnapping in the second degree under the proposed draft. Now, under kidnapping in the first degree, right now in Oregon, we have 163.620, and it defines only kidnapping for ransom as the aggravated form. Now, if we adopt the optional clause, we will be adding to this statute.